Thank you for visiting the Center on Psychiatric Disability and Co-occurring Medical Conditions. The following recording is part of our Health and Wellness podcast library. For more information about our center, please visit our website at www.cmhsrp.uic.edu/health.
And so we're very happy to have our colleague here from the Boston University Center, an authority on physical health among individuals in recovery, Dori Hutchinson.
Okay, a little bit about who I am. I'm the Director of Services at the Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation, and I oversee a variety of programs that help people eventually self-determine their lives through education. We provide education in all the domains of wellness and serve about 150 people on any given day. And I've been doing this for about 25 years and run into a lot of bumps along the way. But the most immovable bump that I have run into is that of death. And the importance of this issue in psychiatric rehabilitation is what I want to talk about today. Because people cannot self-determine anything if they are dying. People cannot self-determine where they want to live, what they want to do with their lives, who they want to love, who they want to be in life if they are sick and dying. So this is an opportunity, I think, to challenge our thinking on why this is happening and what we might do differently so that this no longer remains such a fierce issue for people. We need to begin with a fundamental principle that we believe that optimal health is a basic human right and that people with mental illnesses are people and they're human beings. It seems very, very straightforward, but then why are we still counting bodies? Why do we still count bodies? We need to work to ensure that there are social and economic conditions that are going to allow people to achieve optimal health. And we need to shift our stubborn focus that we have on the illness to treating the whole person. We need to promote health. We need to prevent disease and disability. We need to begin to see this issue from a social justice perspective, and that our goal is to help people achieve health equity through self-determination and shared decision-making. My voice is really a small voice on this issue where health equity is concerned. As Lisa said, Peggy Swarbrick is an inspirational voice and someone that I look to for a lot of direction around this issue. But while I'm passionate about it and I'm optimistic, I get frustrated, I get enraged by this issue, I'm only one voice. So today I've brought with me some of the voices of people that use our services through the public health methodology of PhotoVoice. You will see and hear from folks on what they think the critical issues are in health, and what they think contributes to this fierce urgency of death and what they believe needs to happen so that they can live, learn, work, and love with health. Because without health as our personal foundation, people cannot recover. So this man that stands before you, his name is Kofi, and he never realized his dreams. He was a student in our program for 5 years. And his voice was silenced this past summer at the age of 27. He died from a massive heart attack brought on most likely by the lethal combination of a mental illness, too many psychiatric medications, poverty, smoking, obesity, unhealthy lifestyles, lack of coordinated care, ethnic and racial disparities over a short lifetime, and lack of education. He lost more than the average 25 years that people with mental illness lose. He lost 47 years, and we lost 47 years of a man on the verge of emerging into a life filled with a career that he had worked really hard towards, a woman to love, and endless possibilities. A family lost their son, their brother, their uncle, and I lost a friend on that day, yet another friend. But I'm going to refuse to lose hope, because he stands as my inspiration, as I'm sure you all have your own inspirations from people that you've seen die too early who also live with psychiatric illnesses. The costs are really multiple and many. People are losing their lives from diseases that are preventable, both on an individual level and at the level of our practices and policies and programs. The epidemic of disease is not ours alone in psychosocial rehabilitation and recovery, because it's really a national epidemic, but it's magnified for people with serious mental illnesses. People with serious mental illnesses now represent the largest health disparity in the nation over any other ethnic and racial group in the United States. So we call ourselves a health care system, but in fact we're not. We really are a sick care system. The social inequality that people with serious mental illness experience has profound consequences, not just for themselves, but for our communities. When people can't assume healthy roles, they lose hope, and our communities experience the burden. We lose out on a potential workforce. We exceed costs. We spend money we don't have. We have to cut services, which only reinforces illness, disease, and disability, and reinforces the erosion of hope. And when people in recovery, as people in communities and in our society, lose hope, injustice and inequities grow. So it's really critical that we engage in sort of a vigorous analysis of what we need to do that is an alternative vision of what we have now. Because our sick care system is really bankrupt, and we cannot sustain ourselves ethically or financially. And we need to consider what the target causes are of not only the disease and disability, but of the health disparities. I think that when we look at this issue from these perspectives, it's going to feel like a threat to a lot of people. But I think counting bodies is unacceptable and unethical. Ignoring whole person health has also produced unsustainable costs. We need reform in rehabilitation and treatment, and we need to develop effective strategies to improve the health, to promote the health of persons who live with serious mental illnesses, and also to significantly reduce the costs, not only the costs that are financial, but the costs of a life full of meaning. And then we need to assess the impact of health on all of its intricate woven factors: people's wellness, their work, their housing, their money, our politics and policies and practices. And we need to hold ourselves accountable to ensure that people have a right to self-determine what health means to them. So as I mentioned, Photo Voice is a way of giving voice to disenfranchised people through images and narratives of issues that concern them. So I'm going to give you a second to take a look at this. This image and the words reflect many opportunities to challenge and consider. Polypharmacy is a significant determinant of the health of people with serious mental illnesses and the fiscal health of our system. And it has many, many costs individually and systemically. It speaks to the issue of shared decision making, health literacy, poverty, integrated care, and health communication. It challenges us to reconsider the paradigm and the singular focus on medication as the frontline response to disease and all its consequences. It challenges us because many believe recovery is impossible without medications. And it stirs us because it allows us to imagine our own health routine replaced by this regimen. The serious health threats and the excessive urgency of death is unfortunately nothing new. As was said this morning, the fierce urgency of now has been going on for a really long time. And this list is just a short list of how the fierce urgency of now has been going on for a long time around the fact that people with serious mental illness have been dying. It's not exhaustive by any means. But I think it provides us with a smattering of the fact that the evidence is there. There's 90 years of research evidence, 90, that have been telling us for 90 years that people with serious mental illness live with excessive disease and die prematurely from preventable health conditions. We in psychosocial rehabilitation have been doing research on this for 22 years. We even, in the field of recovery or in the world of recovery, have a project. Many of you may know of it, called From Numbers to Names, Pat Deegan's project, where she is researching the unmarked graves and cemeteries around the country, state hospitals, which is an awesome project. But the fact that we actually have a project that has to do that, to me, says something about our value system. In more recent years, in the last 6 years, we've had multiple federal mandates and policies and position statements. The New Freedom Commission, the Wellness Health Summit, Building Bridges, Mental Health Consumers and Primary Care Provider Dialogue, the NASHPID report, SAMHSA's Vision and Pledge, Mental Health America's position statement in 2007. And over these years, since 1919, the mortality rate has gone from 5 years to 10 years to 15 years to 20 years to 25 years, and it is still growing. So this list calls to me about the elephant in the room. Why do we still not make health a priority? I recently presented to a state mental health hospital, their providers and patients and family members in the room, and only a few people were aware of the issue and were aware of this list of evidence. These calls to action, these positions on health. If we continue to turn a blind eye to the issues of disease and premature mortality, and if we allow stigma to dictate what is priority, and if we continue to wait for others to develop evidence-based practices, we're going to still be counting bodies. These words speak to the urgency of treating the whole person. We have separated the mind and the body and the spirit for far too long. We've failed to make an upfront investment in prevention. Instead, we spend billions on traditional therapies. We must consider the wonderful diversity of health to meet the diverse needs of the people that we serve and of ourselves in recovery. Considering a full spectrum of services and programs that focus on wellness is something that we struggle with philosophically and fiscally. Respecting self-determined treatment, alternative or traditional, is something that's difficult for us to do, and we need to ask ourselves why that is. I think there are a lot of myths when it comes to health and wellness, particularly in the mental health field, and I think they're important to talk about. And again, this isn't an exhaustive list, but I think myths, taking a look at the myths, helps provide some clarity for the future. And these myths are everywhere in our society, our cultures, and in the mental health community. And I think we're overwhelmed by these myths. They've become the reasons why we can't change, why achieving wellness on the individual or programmatic or system level feels often unattainable. I hear them all the time, all over the country, from all types of people. And maybe you'll recognize them as well. People with serious mental illness are not motivated to change their health behaviors. I hear this almost daily, and people quickly cite the evidence. They say things like, well, you know, we started a walking program, but no one came. So, you know, people don't really want to walk, so we no longer do it. But what really is at work here is the reality of health behavior change and motivation to change is an issue of readiness to change. And we're an action-oriented society, and we're action-oriented in the mental health system as well. But people, including people with serious mental illness, are usually just contemplating health behavior change. And they need opportunities to improve their health literacy so they can self-determine what they need to live a life full of optimal health. They need opportunities to increase their skills with autonomy and mutual support, and it's a perfect match for consumer-led services and psychiatric rehabilitation services. You hear that reimbursement and credentials are barriers to providing health promotion services. And yes, this is true. They are barriers, but they're quickly disappearing. Quite a few states now are reimbursing through Medicaid for nutrition education and supported physical activity services for folks because it's become medically necessary. And we also know from the public health world that both nutrition and activity promote health and prevent disease. It's a long-term, upfront investment in people's health. Finding people who have the competencies and the credentials to deliver health promotion services is doable. Assisting people in recovery to acquire the skills and credentials in health-related professions is also a great response. Peggy's doing this in New Jersey. People are doing it in Massachusetts and Arizona. Mandating health as an outcome eliminates choice and sets up programs to fail. I think this is a relatively new barrier that gets thrown out there, where people throw the values of recovery up as the reason not to promote health. It really makes the hair on the back of my neck go up. Programs worry that they will be held accountable if they don't see improved health outcomes. So we need to ask why they aren't being held accountable now for all the death and disease that's happening. Why is that outcome okay? I think the key word here is mandate, because it sets up a power struggle. We know that assisting people to self-determine what wellness means to them by offering choices will promote well-being and improved health. We know that from population-based and community-based health research that outreach and education and prevention opportunities work for all types of people with all types of challenges. Physical illness is the least of their problems. Hear that a lot as well. But I disagree with that. Physical illness is the biggest problem if it prevents us from learning, working, loving, and living. If we're faced with such illness that death is a possibility, then it is our biggest challenge. It is our urgent now. We need health evidence-based practices and programs for this population. We all know the value of excellent evidence. I am a firm believer in it. But where health is concerned, I believe that waiting for specialized evidence-based practices to tell us how to help people with serious mental illness eat and move and sleep and live well is not only unnecessary, but it's dangerous, because people with mental illness are dying while we're waiting for these. People with mental illness are people like everyone else, and we have health practices that are based in evidence that just need minor tweaking and modifications according to people's cultural needs, literacy needs, and cognitive needs. Culture and environment are less important than services provided. The health of our culture and our environments is really critical in improving the health of people. Having clean spaces, fresh water, natural light and air, having people who walk the talk in environments will help people live healthier lives. Disability precludes wellness. Many believe that wellness cannot coexist with disability, and I think this myth helps support the focus on people's illness and the separation of mind and body and spirit. Mental health is not a part of overall health and functioning. Similarly, the lack of integration of mental health and physical health, because they are seen as separate, has hurt all of us. And in more so, it has hurt folks with serious mental illness. Optimal health is the best possible functioning of our mind and body and spirit together. And finally, this last one, the unspoken but present belief that early death is a blessing. I actually had a physician, a psychiatrist from a renowned institute, say this out loud to me in a grands round that I was doing. And I think it's an unspoken belief that is held by many who see people with serious mental illness as somehow less than and less deserving of health because they are living with a serious mental illness. This person's voice challenges us to normalize health. We all can take steps. It's often argued that health are solely matters of personal responsibility. And it is a matter of self-determined choices. But we must, as a system, take responsibility for our policies and practices that influence people's health. We can all take action. We can provide different levels of messaging that says that your health matters and that people with serious mental illness matter. People with serious mental illness have a right to self-determine their health and well-being. And to help people realize this right to live a long and healthy life, we need to work together to prioritize this public health disparity. It's going to take policymakers, people in recovery, people at the system level, providers, family members, everyone working together. the integration of physical and mental health care to ensure high quality access to health care, not just sick care, will support a more person-centered mental health system. Building capacity in people in recovery and providers to share decisions related to health and improving health literacy will also improve people's health and support health self-determined wellness. Providing opportunities to increase skills and supports related to overall health will have a protective benefit, not just for the individual, but for our system as well. Collaboration and coordination will increase, communication will improve, cost savings will occur. If our mission in psychiatric rehabilitation is to help people achieve chosen, valued roles, then working together to reduce premature mortality and excessive illness is our business. We need to reflect on how we can assist people to self-determine what optimal health means to them. We need to shift the locus of control from the external. We need to shift it from program rules, regulations, and staff to the individuals we serve through opportunities for self-control of health resources, management, and choice. So I think we're in a health recession. We are certainly in one in our nation, and I think we're one in the world of psychiatric rehabilitation. And people in recovery are experiencing a profound health recession, and so are our programs and our system. We need to assist people to make informed health choices by increasing health literacy. Health literacy plays a key role in a person's ability to obtain and use health education, and men then make self-determined health choices. Optimal health is a critical factor if people are going to have a chance at a long life. We must support education of providers and peers and families to facilitate healthy choices while promoting personal responsibility. And we need to examine our care process. I think there's a lot of stigma and discrimination in our process and in our healthcare settings. And we need to help people understand the hopeful message of recovery and engage people as equal partners in their health care. We need to support the wellness and empowerment of people through programs that are culturally respectful, peer-led, and take full advantage of the vast public health knowledge that is out there in our community. And we need to continue to advocate for healthcare reform. By utilizing the many recommendations that have been made by the New Freedom Commission, the Institute of Medicine, SAMHSA, Mental Health America, the list goes on and on and on. The recommendations are out there. We're not taking advantage of them. And we need to join forces with public health agencies and Medicare and Medicaid to develop initiatives and pathways so that there are funding mechanisms to do things like health education and primary prevention services and smoking cessation and nutrition services. When we assure that there are financing methods for health promotion, what we'll be doing is taking a long-run cost avoidance strategy. So we'll be making an upfront investment in people's lives rather than a short-term investment in their illness and disability. But then we also need to account for those savings to reduce the unacceptable costs that this health disparity is having on people's lives and on our system level. We must think about how our current policies and practices influence and impact people's health. And these words speak to that. People with serious mental illness experience an unacceptable high burden of disease, disability, and premature death. We need to understand what the underlying causes of this health disparity is and then support effective policies that build self-determined health as a resource, as a personal resource for people's recovery. Reconnecting the mind, the body, and the spirit starts with health literacy. Personal responsibility grows when health literacy is strengthened. We need to commit and invest in implementing and modifying population-based education and outreach programs to improve the health of people who live with serious mental illnesses. Increasing people's skills and supports will result in informed and responsible health decisions. We know that people with poor health literacy incur medical expenses that are 4 times higher than people who have health knowledge and skills. Health literacy is a stronger predictor of health than age, income, race, education, and employment status. And we know that health literacy can happen anywhere. It can happen in an emergency room, inpatient settings, outpatient settings, peer-run programs, coffee shops, on the phone, by email, on the web, in person. It is inexpensive and it's essential. It's a step that we can all take by informing others about the importance of this issue to engaging people in their health care. I know that Lisa has a new dog, so this probably resonates for her. I think this speaks to the fact that health is experienced in diverse ways. The value of choice, personal responsibility, and one size does not fit all are reflected here. We know that loneliness kills people and reduces quality of life for many, many people. Relationships with animals and relationships with humans have protective effects on people's health, and everyone benefits when no one is left behind. So we must refuse, as the quote, as Martin Luther King's quote said on the conference flyer, we must refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. I think we need to get outraged and remain outraged that people are devalued by allowing premature death and excessive illness. These are the consequences and the outcomes of our policies, our practices, and our attitudes. But change is happening, and working together, we can instill hope that we can eliminate the root causes of this disparity. We can all contribute by marketing, empowering, and incenting healthy changes in our attitudes, our policies, and our practices. But we need to advocate for comprehensive, quality, affordable health care through health reform and to ensure that it's culturally relevant and culturally respectful, so that people can self-determine what optimal health means to them. I think to do this, we have to champion a culture of health in our mental health communities. Health is a human issue. We all strive for it. We all struggle with it. And it's a bridge which we can build mutual relationships between all stakeholders. We can use what is out there, the vast, diverse messages and interventions on health. We can train and hire people in recovery to mentor and inspire others that health is a right, a responsibility, and it is attainable. And finally, I think it's really important that we have to resist this urge to develop a tyranny of health, sliding down sort of this slippery slope of power where we judge people on how healthy they are according to one set standard of health determinants. Instead, we need to give people back the power to define, discover, and determine what health means to them. This is one of my favorite Photo Voice slides. This drain calls to me because of all the hurtful things people have said to me over the decades about my mental illness. In sum, I have been told that I am a drain on the nation, a drain on society, and a drain on multiple individuals' resources. Over the years, I have come to believe this, which has become a drain on me. Education about mental illness, my health, the effects of trauma, should be available to me as well as healthcare professionals. Knowledge and understanding can be powerful weapons in combating stigma and helping people live long, healthy lives.
Thank you for listening. You can listen to additional podcasts or download a transcript by visiting us at www.cmhsrp.uic.edu/health and clicking the link for the podcast library.